We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
And before we go any further, I'd just like to remind you that this is day two of our end-of-year mini drive. We are raising money that will support the programming that you hear on the station next year. And that's an important idea to get across. This is something we've been doing for a long time now here. We raise money 1 year that we will spend in the next year. And I'm talking about the fiscal year that begins on July 1st. So we are raising the money that will pay for next year's programming, and we just have a couple of weeks to do it. And we have a very ambitious goal. We're hoping that by the end of June, we will have raised $196,000. Actually, this is our June goal, $196,500. That is a lot of money, but we're making some good progress. And so we want to reach out to people who listen to the station. If it's an important part of your life, but you're not a financial supporter, now would be a good time to change that. And it's very easy. You can decide on the amount, but we hope before that you will decide that you will be a supporter and make it possible for us to continue to bring you programs like Focus and Morning Edition and All Things Considered and the Afternoon Magazine and the Ag Service and everything else that we do here. Real easy. Take you just a minute or two. You can telephone to 217-244-9455. Make your pledge that way. Or if you would like, and a lot of people I think are doing it this way now, you can go online. Go to willpledge.org. Either way you make your pledge, you'll be investing in a service that you use and that you value. And when you do that, we'll say thanks very much. In this hour of Focus, we'll be doing our monthly show on money management and personal finance. And we're pleased to have back here on the show once again Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business. And he kind of trades off with Dave Sinnoh to do the program. And Dave is, I assume he's fishing or some such thing. We're really happy to have Kevin here to do the program that we do on a regular basis here every month. So people who are listening, if you have specific questions, you can call us, the number 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that too. will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, you give us a call and we'll be very happy to talk with you. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, David. It's always good to be here.
I don't know if there's anything in real particular you want to talk about. One of the things I guess I was thinking as I was noodling around here looking at the various sites where they have information on investing, there was something that caught my eye that I thought was kind of interesting, and it had to do with putting together a portfolio of stocks. And the advice, of course, always is that you want to be diversified. And Dave, for example, we have this couch potato portfolio that has, how many does it have? About
nine different mutual funds.
Mm-hmm. And the point of this particular article, I was looking at it was someone who was asking this question, well, how diversified do I have to mm-hmm. be diversified? And because you might have several different funds may not necessarily mean that you have what you and Dave and other people would say, what you're talking about when you say be diversified. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's a great question, because if you were to think about the pure statistical aspect of the word diversification, what you're really trying to do is get the benefit of asset classes, perhaps even individual assets, whose price patterns are not highly correlated. So in a simple sense, you're trying to look for something that zigs when something else zags. And if you put enough of those together, you shouldn't be exposed, at least statistically, you shouldn't be exposed to everything moving in the same direction at the same time. That type of risk is what diversification is attempting to eliminate. In actually exacting the process, how to do it, let's start with the couch potato portfolio that Dave Sinnoh has shepherded for how many years now. Remember, each one of those investments within that portfolio is a mutual fund. So each one of those nine investment selections itself is a diversified holding of securities. That said, each one of those funds then has a different focus area and a different, asset class of management. For example, one of those funds is a REIT fund, a real estate investment trust, obviously focuses on real estate values and lives or dies by the performance of that marketplace. Another one is large U.S.-based companies, the S&P 500 index, the 500 largest U.S.-based companies. So, again, the goal in diversification is to find things that don't all move in lockstep.
So this, when you look at that, you see it's broken up, as you say. There is some money that's going into the international market, so that's companies outside of the United States. There's some money that's in the REIT, so you have some money in real estate, and then it also breaks it down in terms of some money in real big companies, and then in sort of medium sized companies, and then sort of smaller sized companies, and that way. Hopefully you should get even more diversification than if you went into one fund that was the S&P 500. Or even there are funds that do, they're quite broad, but they have certain ways to weight the investments so that it doesn't necessarily mean that an equal amount of your money goes into everything that's in there.
Right, right. And that is a part of the process that a person needs to tailor that type of advice to their own personal objectives, their own personal constraints. And maybe this is a good time to bring up the old phrase that kind of applies to this tailoring process, which is to say, do you want to eat well or do you want to sleep well? It's difficult to have a mix of exposure to risky assets that allows people to do both. So we all like the thought of getting a high rate of return. We all dislike the uncomfortable position when that doesn't happen. Mm. So eating well or sleeping well, that's the personal tailoring part. That's the aspect of a person kind of fine-tuning those overall advisory type of positions.
Yeah. And different people, I'm sure, that will give you different models for these kinds of allocations. But as you say, the idea is you really want to put something together that you can have go. Now, you also do want to review this, say, once a year. You might like to take a look at where your money is going. But the idea is that you don't want to, if you're the kind of person that says, look, I don't want to worry about this, then that's the idea. You can set it up, and you don't have to be checking every day, and you don't have to be up at night thinking about, have I put my money in the right places?
Yeah, if you find yourself thinking about these types of things frequently, you're obviously either very interested in things. Maybe it's a hobby, or it's something that is root to your profession. Most people are not going to have a hobby of investing, and I would say that for the most part, very many people are not going to have a root element in their careers that are investing. So bottom line is, thinking about things once a year is sort of like an annual checkup with your doctor, always a good thing just to get that kind of overview. Another thing that might go along with it, and this, again, is subject to debate, is an annual rebalancing. For instance, just a very simple portfolio, split it into stocks and bonds. If in those two asset classes during the past year, one has appreciated in value and the other has not, or maybe even gone down in value, a person might be inclined to look at that and say, well, this is the opportunity I have to do a rebalancing. If I started out with 70% stocks, 30% in bonds, and because of market changes, I'm now 80-20. Well, you pull a little money off the table, which means to say you take profits, you sell at a higher price, you move that money into those assets that have either stayed the same, not gone up as fast in value, or have even gone down in value. So that annual rebalancing process for some people tends to work well, and that kind of fits into the you don't need to be involved every day.
Yeah, and maybe just one other, this is a simple idea, maybe again people understand this, but and that is the importance of sitting, you sit down and you say, in this year I have this much money I want to invest. So what you want to do is you want to split that up 12 ways and every month put that much in. And that way what you're doing is tending to kind of blunt any big swings one way or another. You know, you don't have to decide when's the right time to go in. If you say, well, we'll just put in X amount of dollars every month. It's called income averaging. And that way you don't have to worry about, is it up this month? Is it down this month? Do I put money in or do I not?
Yeah, the process of routine purchases, say every month, brings up the principle or the practice of dollar cost averaging.
Dollar cost averaging.
And basically, it's an extension of, it's a very simple technique, but it's a very powerful technique over time. And it's an extension of nothing more than good budget practices. Hopefully every month a person budgets personal savings. So if you thought of that as the beginning point, the extension might be every month a person budgets a certain purchases of securities, long-term investments, things that they don't plan on needing anytime soon. And the process of dollar cost averaging, as you just laid it out, is a real simple but powerful practice. Given the volatility of markets, when prices are down, the same number of dollars are buying more of those assets. It's like going to the store when, milk is on sale. When the prices are higher, well, you're happy for what you own, but those same number of dollars in that month are buying fewer of the higher priced items. Over time, you hope that your average cost, obviously, is lower than a market value at a time when you think that you need to sell some or all and realize on those assets.
Yeah, okay.
So very simple tools, very easy to enact, certainly with most employers in a retirement plan. They do offer salary savings plans of one variety or another. In the private sector, they're usually known as 401k plans. In the not-for-profit or educational sector, 403b plans. But again, a person literally says, take this amount of my money out of my paycheck each payroll run, and then divvy it up in these different investment opportunities.
Our
Real
guest
simple.
In this hour is Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business, and every once in a while here stops by as part of our regular monthly series on personal finance. And the idea is, you know, he and I can chat here, but the idea is that he's here to answer your questions. So if something specific, some questions you have about your own investment strategies or money management planning, and you're not quite sure what to do, you'd like to have a little advice or at least get his opinion, you can call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So we save you some money on the call. And then if you would like to send us email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here when we have calls or got emails, we'll get them in. Maybe I would ask you a little bit about planning for college for your kids. And people are certainly counseled to start putting away money as soon as they have children, maybe even before they have children, so that you've built up a fund that you can draw on. There have been some concerns lately, I think, about the college savings plan of the state of Illinois. I'm not quite sure how other states are doing here. And I think the problem is that the nice thing for people is that it guarantees you a certain, you know, it guarantees that the money will be there and your kids can go to college. I think the problem for the state of Illinois and maybe some other states too is that they really didn't anticipate just how fast tuition prices would be going up. So I guess the question is, if you were going to save for college, what do you think about using a plan like that, just as opposed to setting up some other kind of investment vehicle and then putting in every month, putting in whatever you can put in?
Saving for the future, again, is I think, regardless of the purpose, whether it's retirement, down payment on eventual purchase of a house, college education of dependent children, The basic budgeting process cannot be overemphasized as to how important that is for a person to basically be in control of their money rather than having money control them. That said, my personal preference has not been the sponsored plans, the 529 plans, whether it's College Illinois or any other available plan, has not really been my preference. And I've got two basic reasons for it. The first reason is, along with the advantages some of that saving structure has from a tax aspect, there are give-ups. There is a loss of flexibility. Another aspect is, as you've just mentioned, the word guarantee is a word that I think in the 21st century is going to become more and more explored, more and more challenged. And, you know, we could all make jokes about how messed up the state of Illinois is. The fact is it's not a joke. It's a sad story. But the bottom line is I am never opposed to a person using a little logic and common sense, setting up what I would call a reasonable budget and then sticking to it. It is, if we're all about entitlement in today's society, a person ought to be entitled to manage their own monetary affairs. And the, how should we say, giving that responsibility to somebody else just has, in my opinion, some unpleasant surprise potential. Some of those are coming due now.
We have a caller here, someone to talk with, and the caller is in Urbana, line number one, right here. Hello.
Hi. It's always delightful to listen to the recent comments of Kevin Waspy. I do have a question. It's a little bit specific, and this involves the state retirement system, the SERS, State University Retirement System. Recently, the Board of Trust, the board of SERS, voted to change the rates of annuities for individuals who are on the money purchase plan. And of course, they reduce the annuities. If you're familiar with this, Kevin, could you give us some advice? Perhaps advice to individuals who are not yet maxed out, and perhaps advice to individuals who are maxed out. I think the change in annuities is going to begin on July 1st, 2012. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's a very interesting development. It's been in the works for a number of months. It's a rather complicated and involved. And let me try to boil it down to what I hope will be succinct and not and not giving it a short shrift. For a large class of employees at the university systems, including the University of Illinois, Eastern Illinois University, across the state of Illinois, for a large class of employees, depending on their hire date, at the time they retire, their benefit is calculated to be the maximum of one of two methodologies. The first methodology is called the formula approach. It's basically 2.2% of the person's salary. The salary is determined as the last 4 years' average salary, and the 2.2% of that average times the number of years of service. The alternative is what's referred to as a money purchase program. The money purchase calculation works a little like this. Each year, the employee has had 8% of their salary pay into the SERS trust fund, and that's conscription. Employees such as myself view that as a comparable to the Social Security plan that we do not participate in. So the bottom line is every year of income, 8% of that has been paid into the State University Retirement System, and each year you get an annual report that shows you the credit to your account, the balance in your account, which includes the earnings attributed to the year prior. So a lot like a 401k statement that a person in the private sector would receive, that balance is reported to you each year. So again, back to the time of retirement. The second methodology, then, this money purchase formula says if you choose a life annuity as your benefit, the money in the account and the assumed rate of return that money can earn over your expected lifespan could theoretically purchase you a commercial annuity. You go to an insurance company, you say, here's the sum of money I have. They look at your age. They look a little bit at your health. They basically assume what rate of return they can earn on that money as you hand it over to them, and that determines what amount of money per month they'll pay you in this life annuity, meaning as long as you live. That calculation determines, again, at CSRS, a monthly benefit. If the monthly benefit under the money purchase plan is greater than the 2.2% formula approach, then that's the benefit you're given. What's being changed July 1, 2012 is that assumed rate of return. And quite frankly, it's a reflection of reality. It's being lowered from, just as a comparable, in December this past year, the money rate of credit in the account that was running at 8.25% was lowered to 7.75%. Now, in today's interest rate environment and today's earnings environment, 7.75% is still hugely generous in terms of growing that credit in the account balance, growing the balance itself from earnings. CSRS has done a good job with investment rates of return, but that's 7.75% in today's environment is still huge. Bottom line is the annuity calculation rate is being lowered to more effectively match the earnings credit rate that would be used in that money purchase calculation. And here's what it all means. For a person who's worked in a university system for a long period of time, 99 chances out of 100, the 2.2% formula is going to produce a higher benefit. So it's a moot point to them that the money purchase formula calculation is being changed effective July 1 a year from now. For a person who may have 10, 12, 15 years, 20 years of employment, but they've reached the age of 60, 65. They've come to the university after a career elsewhere. They've come to the university, as I did, from the private sector. They've got a situation where perhaps retiring before that change in the money purchase calculation might impact their monthly annuity by as much as 7 or 8%. So if their annuity was going to be $1,000 a month, it might be $920 a month. And that's the kind of decision I believe we'll be seeing a lot of people who are 60, 62, 65 begin to make a year from this spring. So as we move closer to that July 1, 2012 date, the person will, if they're wise, consider what they're doing in their life. They'll probably make an appointment to go see a benefit rep at CSRS. They'll have the person calculate the benefit payable if they retire and then say, well, what will be the impact if I retired a month later? That's a prudent thing to do.
Okay. And if that's all, and in spite of just how clear Kevin is trying to make this, if this is still confusing, the thing to do is to call over to CSRS, and they have very nice folks there whose job it is to sit down and to explain it to you. And particularly people who are thinking about the possibility of retiring, say, let us say, maybe within the next year or two.
Exactly.
You should just, you know, just be aware of this. Go over there, sit down, and they can lay it all out for you.
That's a part of the normal procedure anyway. When a person gets ready to retire from the university, they should always do some pre-planning. And the trip to CSRS is just one of those elements in pre-planning.
Yeah, all right. Well, I hope that that gets to the question of the caller. Other callers are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We need to talk a minute here to talk about money, your money, and what you do with it in terms of investing. Now, there's all sorts of places you could put your money to get a benefit, and we talk about some of them on this program. Let me suggest something else. How about calling in and making a pledge to this radio station? Now you say to me, but Dave, that's not an investment. Well, actually it is, because the benefits to you, the dividends, are the programs that you get every time you turn on the station. That's the way to think about it. You are making an investment in great programming for the year ahead with your pledge. Now is a great time to do that. And here in the studio with me, I'm very happy to have Debbie Hamlet. She is our Director of Development for Illinois Public Media, and she's been here for about 2 weeks.
Only 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
And it's, I have to say, this has been a real eye-opener to be able to listen to this program and get introduced to a lot of different, a variety of topics that are interested, you know, for me, new to the area. I would imagine this is a great investment for those of you who are listening.
I would like to think so. And we've been doing it for a while, 30 years this year.
30 years, wow. That's an investment on its own right there.
So for people, for if this is just a regular part of your day, if you're able to listen during the show, and there are a lot of people who are, and then there are a lot of people who also listen to the podcast, they go back and listen to shows afterwards. Maybe you're listening to this program after the fact. You can still go online and make a pledge.
That's right.
So that's what we want you to do.
That's right. Less than $196,000 to go to meet the end of the year budget goal for this fiscal year, and every pledge makes a difference. Every pledge is important. Every pledge is an investment, and it's spent very wisely. And I can tell you, having only been here a couple of weeks, I have seen the budget. I have seen where the money is spent, and it is very, it's calculated very, let's just say we spend a lot of time on those things. We think a lot about how what's the best investment of the money. We don't take those things lightly. And I can tell that having only been here for a short time, although my previous time was 15 years in public broadcasting, and I can tell you every public broadcasting station does that. Mm-hmm. They take this very seriously. It is a huge part of the budget equation. And you're needed right now. And right now is a good time to call. Right now, while you're listening, and you're getting this very good advice about investments. And I've looked at a lot of these topics that you've covered over the last even month or so. Anything from, let's see, history of Illinois to human social networks in real evolutionary time. I mean, there's a lot of information on this program that you're probably not going to find anywhere else. Because you're listening, because you value this program, we're asking you to call right now with a pledge. Yeah. And you can do that by going to willpledge.org or by calling 217-244-9455. So just take a moment, make your pledge now, and you'll know that it's being spent very wisely here.
Well, thank you very much. And so you can do that. You can call. You can go online, whichever way you do it. This is just a short effort here. We're doing 4 days. And here on Focus, this is day two of 2 days.
That's
so
right.
They're not going to be another opportunity for you to make a contribution.
That's right. It's
Focus.
2 days of 4 days. So we've got the first day phenomena where people say, "Oh, I want to get in on that. That's the first day. I want to make sure and help." And then you've got the procrastinators who will wait till the last day. And guess what? It's next to the last day. So come on, don't wait until tomorrow. We need you today.
All right. Thank you very much, Debbie. Thanks to everybody who's called. And if you haven't done it yet, we hope you will make the call or go online. And this morning in this hour of Focus, this is our monthly show dealing with financial planning and money management. And the idea is, if you have a specific question, here's my situation, you can call in and give us some information and say, you know, what do you think I should do? Should I do this? Should I do this? And you can take advantage of our guest here, Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business, and he can give you some advice. And we want you to think very carefully about what you do with your money, but this is one little piece that you can use as you do think about that. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And just one note here, if people are interested, we will be updating the couch potato portfolio, but I think that we won't be able to do that until after the show, because I think we have some. So Harriet wants to ask you about something, but in any case, look for that, and we do update that every month, so we'll get you that basic information. Here we have somebody, an email from someone who has this question. If I am 5 to 10 years away from retirement, does it still make sense to put savings into a tax-deferred account, such as a 403B, given the likelihood that taxes will be going up?
That's an excellent question. I think it's still possibly prudent to do so. One of the aspects of the 403B is the notion of that forced savings component. If we made the assumption that you were perfectly disciplined and you would save the money in a scheme, an arrangement outside of payroll deduction, then we could take that aspect away. But most people find that they fit their standard of living to their take-home pay. I've seen this enough over the years to say that even the most disciplined of people occasionally will be less than what the budget plan is. Now, I do know, I can count on one hand, a few individuals that would literally say something like, I don't have the first nickel I made, but I do have the second. So those people aside, most of us benefit from a forced savings aspect of a 403B. The other thing I would consider is this. Has the person used an after-tax savings vehicle such as a Roth IRA? And if the answer is no, or they haven't used it to the extent possible, there might be a very, very good reason for them to be saving money in a Roth IRA. In a Roth IRA arrangement, they get no current year tax advantage. The money that goes in there is already taxed money. But the advantages come down the road, and they can be as many and varied as a greater flexibility, no tax aspects at time of withdrawal, might even be an estate planning tool to some degree. So again, as with many questions that go to specifics, my answer is always I can talk on the surface of it, but so many of the questions about what's best or what's optimal, what makes sense for the person, literally need more exploration and digging. But I encourage you to think broadly when you think of those questions.
All right. We have some other callers here. We'll go to Effingham, line 4 on the phone here. Hello.
Yes. I want to know, what about these debentures? I'll take the answer on the air, but they're paying like 4.5%, but you have to be locked in for maybe 6 years. Could you explain that to us, please?
Before you leave, when you say debentures, are you talking about corporate bonds?
Yeah, this would be a corporation.
Uh-huh. Sure. Well, that's a great question. Corporate bonds are a way for people to invest money in a fixed income instrument that are, well, I would say not a lot different from what we've talked about on the show in the past in terms of U.S. Treasury securities. So instead of lending money to your federal government by the purchase of a U.S. Treasury note that might mature in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and pay you interest every 6 months, a corporate debenture or general obligation of the issuer is basically lending money to a company. Now, the thing to remember is this. Although the maturity is a fixed date in the future, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever, every day that we rip a sheet off the calendar is one day closer to maturity. But the more important thing is this. These securities are traded in liquid markets. Some securities are much more liquid than others. So, again, back to the U.S. Treasury notes, 2-year notes, 10-year notes. They are bought and sold in the trillions of dollars every day the market is open. So it's a very liquid, very deep market. Now, that's not a panacea. It is access to the money prior to maturity. You find another buyer to buy it from you prior to the maturity date. The caveat, of course, is at what price? And here's the thing to remember. Interest rates and bond prices move inversely. Interest rates right now are at 50-plus year lows. If interest rates move higher, the value, the price of a bond, whether it's a U.S. Treasury security or a corporate security, will go lower. And that's one of the reasons a person has to be very, cognizant of not stretching for yield. So, in the neighborhood of corporate debentures, the next thing we would add is default risk. The types of yields available on corporate debt right now, in my opinion, are not as juicy as they appear. Not only do we have interest rate risk, as we would with every fixed income security, now we have the environment of default risk. It's an obligation of the corporation. If the corporation cannot make the payments, there's a likelihood that you might end up with a substantial loss. the value of securities in firms such as Enron, that 15 years ago was considered the darling of investors and the darling of all of the analysts on Wall Street, literally end up returning about 13 cents of every dollar to a person that held the corporate debt of Enron when it went broke. So bear in mind, those are the kinds of things that go along with a 4.5%, 5% rate of return that might be available to a person with a corporate 5-year security right now.
Once again, hope that gets at the question of the caller. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Kevin Waspy is our guest. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business. This is our monthly show on money management, and we're open to whatever questions you have about your finances. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that too. It's a will-talk. It's a hyphen, will-talk@illinois.edu. I have some other questions here, some folks who have emails. This is maybe a little bit more of a policy question, but I want to ask.
We like those.
We like those. Okay. In a recent issue of the publication Inside Illinois, which people know on the campus, they read it, there was an article about Illinois pension reform quoting Jeff Brown, who I'm sure you know, in the finance department. He said that he thought it would be a good idea for the pension plan to move to something which he said would be a smartly designed hybrid system with a smaller defined benefit supplemented with an income-oriented defined contribution plan, something like a 403B. And the person who's writing in says, well, isn't that contrary to the kind of diversified portfolio of equities that you advocate during the accumulation phase?
I don't really think the two are necessarily connected. I'm not going to speak for Jeff Brown's thoughts on the structure of the retirement plan. Let me just start out with this. It's my assumption that the funding mechanism for the pension to be paid as it stands now is clearly not working. There are a lot of proposals to do some changing to make it something that works better moving forward. I believe his proposal was one of saying, rather than having the structure in its present form, where an employee pays in 8% of their wage and the state is supposed to match it but doesn't, let's back off from that. Let's promise a less generous certainty and then have a person voluntarily put more of their money in order to fund a greater possible benefit in the future. So that's the aspect of the lower guaranteed amount, if you want to use that word loosely, the lower pension calculation defined benefit amount. And the defined contribution literally says, well, if Kevin wants to put an additional 4 or 5% of his pay into that same retirement plan, then that's what he's defining as an additional contribution. What amount of benefit it produces at time of Kevin's retirement then is not guaranteed, not promised, but is literally based on what growth the money has achieved over that period of time. It basically shifts the burden of investment rates of return and, to a certain extent, the funding deficiencies that we've got in the present arrangement more onto the shoulders of the participants. We could argue the pluses and minuses of that, but as we speak to things like stocks versus bonds, so on and so forth, that now we get to a totally separate environment. Imagine any type of retirement plan, 403B, SERS, whatever it is, your individual IRA. Imagine that as an umbrella, and that umbrella is the place to start. What happens beneath that umbrella? Things like stocks, bonds, real estate, what types of stocks, what types of fixed income investments, treasuries, corporates, junk bonds of corporate issuers, so on and so forth. All of those are the nuances and important things that happen beneath the umbrella. They are not necessarily locked together.
Well, this makes me think of some of the things that people had been, some of the ideas people had been tossing around for Social Security, saying that maybe there it should be a kind of a hybrid system, and part of the money that was coming out of people's paychecks would then be a sort of semi-self-directed plan. Now, also, though, people felt that there needed to be some safeguards built into there to try to help people so that they don't make really bad decisions with that money.
And one of the examples that's often held up as a potential or as a poster child of success is the country of Chile. Because if we went back 25 years ago, most of the South American economies were really upside down. It was a horrible time for many economies throughout the world, but certainly in South America. Chile was one of those companies that privatized their Social Security type of program, their social retirement program. And to date, it's been very successful. In a nutshell, that's basically what they did. They had a government-guaranteed component that was much smaller than it was before. They then conscripted the workforce into retirement contributions to the plan that basically was a defined contribution element. Again, meaning so much of your pay goes into it. What comes out of it in the future is based on the growth rate over the period of time and obviously the period of time and amount of money contributed to it. So it is deemed very successful, because people's benefits have actually risen above the benefit levels that would have been at this under the old arrangement. The burden to the working class, to the taxpayers of the country, have been much lessened than funding the arrangements under the old plan. And in essence, I'd say that they've avoided some of the problems that this country and many, whether you read the headlines on Greece or read about the forecasts for the Social Security program within this country. I mean, we are on the doorstep of needing, right now, I mean, we are on the doorstep of needing to make some very, very important decisions. And those important decisions are not things that you can just postpone and wait, because it's a little bit like seeing a storm on the horizon. You know that it's headed toward you. And you can, if you wish, wait until it's upon you before you decide to go to your basement, but it's really not prudent.
Here's a question that is a little bit more concrete. It goes back to the conversation we had a little bit earlier about saving for college. And someone here writes in, I've heard you say that you thought the state 529 plan may not be the best way to invest for a child or grandchild's education. So the listener is wondering, well, what would you suggest if I wanted to make a small monthly deposit into an account for each grandchild? Is there a way to avoid paying taxes on the withdrawal if used for education, as is the case with the 529 plan?
Yes, there is. And this brings us back to U.S. Treasury securities. There is a nice little tax advantage to using the old Treasury savings bonds, used for educational purposes at the time they're cashed in, provide a tax shield of the build-up, the interest income over time. So, the purchase of Treasury savings bonds for dependent children is a nice thing to do. I mean, you can literally do it without even the kids or the parents knowing it. So if you're doing it for grandkids, I don't mean to sound silly or anything, but I mean, sometimes people need a little bit of help in disciplining their access to money. So if this was something that a grandparent wanted to begin to say, well, you know, I've got three grandchildren, I'd like to help them be able to pay for a college education 15, 18 years from now, regular purchases of U.S. Treasury savings bonds could be those avenues to use. The parents, the kids don't even have to know about it until you decide to literally hand them the savings bonds and say, here you go. Mm-hmm. It's just simple. It's literally cost-free. The rate of return is hideously low, like every other rate of return that we see in our present environment. The rates are set competitively with market rates so that, again, if interest rates return to more normal levels in the coming 5, 7, 10 years, then those rates will rise. But in the meantime, it's just simple.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know, a lot of times simple things just seem to work well.
Something else, I don't know if there's too much to be said about this, but I guess going back to our earlier conversation about diversification, and this is an illustration, I guess, of the hazards sometimes of investing in stocks. I'm just thinking about the news regarding Pandora, and maybe people have heard about this. And Pandora, by the way, is a cool thing. If you have not looked at it, it's an internet radio service, and it's a place that you can go and listen to music if you have an internet connection. And this was, they had an initial public offering, and they went public, and people were very excited about this. And I believe that the stock debuted at about $17 a share and almost immediately lost like a quarter of its value. So a lot of people who bought at 17, very quickly they lost money. Now, who knows what happens in the long run? One of the things about Pandora is that they still haven't made a profit, and maybe someday that they will, but that may be something of a cautionary tale or something that really looks very exciting, and a lot of people are wanting to jump onto it. You have to be a little careful.
The history of new stock offerings is an interesting fable. It's an interesting tale to tell. It's a great campfire story. For every stock that is priced at, let's say, $17 on the initial public offering, and that means literally you're buying the stock through the investment broker community at the time the stock is sold from the company. Now, what we all see in the news is the first day of public trade. So the excitement of seeing a stock priced at $17 begin Wednesday this week with Pandora, for example. Or is it Tuesday? I'm sorry. Begin Tuesday this week trading at 20 and then 22 and then 24. People have visions and thoughts and, you know, wonders. And it's like, gee, I bought something at 17 and the next day it's worth, you know, another 40% more than I paid for it. Well, for every one that happens that way, there are hundreds that don't. So Pandora started out as a $17 initial public offering price. Again, the stock purchased through the investment syndicate. First trades were 20, 22 in that neighborhood, and I think I saw a high price in the neighborhood of 26, maybe at 26. Anyway, long story short, the stock's a $13 stock now, and the answer is there's a lot of excitement that goes into things. Brings me back to one of my favorite sayings, buy the rumor, sell the fact. The rumor was Pandora was going to be a popular stock, not unlike some of the most recent internet IPO type of stocks we've seen. Sad fact of the matter is, although you might think it's a neat company, David, they've been in existence over 10 years and they've yet to make any money. Mm-hmm. I don't figure that out. I mean, I'm simple. I just can't figure out how a company, I mean, why do I want to own a piece of a company that's been in existence 10 years and still hasn't figured out how to make money? If it takes you that long, I believe in Darwin. I'm just not attracted to these things.
Okay, well, we're going to have to finish up there with promise that, again, next month we'll do the show again. Are you going to be here on the show next month?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's in limbo right now. It depends on how bad the votes are on today's show.
Okay, you can call in and vote whether you would like Kevin to be back again next month. It's our own little primary. Kevin Wasby is a lecturer of finance in the University of Illinois College of Business. Occasionally is one of the guests who is here. This is a program that we do every month on the show. And the idea is it's a place that you can call. You can write in an email, say, look, here's my situation. Here's what I'm thinking about doing. How should I think about this? And whoever the guest here, sometimes it's Kevin, sometimes it's Dave Sinnoh, maybe somebody else, and they'll give you the benefit of their advice.
And I appreciate being here. It's always a pleasure. I'm happy as heck to help out in any way I can. And I'd like to remind the listeners that it's time for them to think the same.
All right. And if now you know, you've heard the message enough times, you said, okay, I want to make a contribution, what do I do? Well, that's pretty easy. We made it as easy as possible. You can call. And here is the number. It is 217-244-9455. Take you a minute or two. You can go online to willpledge.org. However you do it, it's very important to us. If you are a listener but not a contributor, you turn that around.